Thank you for coming along to this second of our three workshops to explore the issues of human and labour rights in the wine industry. This is a topic for which there's a growing urgency for the sector to address head on. The wine sector has excellent practices when it comes to the environmental aspects of sustainability, but the human side needs much greater focus. There's been two big recent studies by Oxfam into the wine industry in Italy and from Finwatch looking at the industry in South Africa that have identified some very real challenges. And in the past couple of months, the press has reported on labour rights abuses in both Champagne and Bordeaux. And in both cases, the French public prosecutor is investigating allegations of human trafficking. This public scrutiny is only going to increase, as will regulatory pressure, for example, from the EU's supply chain due diligence legislation. This will mean that these issues, addressing these issues, will increasingly become a matter of market access for the wine sector. But it's also a financial one. I mean, literally, as we were preparing for this meeting this morning, there's an article in Wine Searcher that said that in September, in the month after the allegations in Champagne came to light, sales of champagne dropped 21.2%, which is 7 million fewer bottles sold. Now, one can't always associate that completely with the labour rights abuses, but how many people want to associate a luxury product with people dying in the fields where it's grown? So our first workshop explored what we actually mean by the term human rights to try and unpick what it actually looks like in the real world. And what today's workshop will do is to take us to the next stage and explore how other sectors have addressed these issues and look at some of the internationally agreed guidance designed to help the private sector. Wine's not alone in dealing with labour rights, and other sectors have been doing it for really quite some while. So there's real experience the wine sector can build on. Equally, there's guidance from organisations like the OECD and the UN, which again provides great support to companies. The trouble, I was talking to some of the retailers last week who described the last workshop as being deeply scary. We're hoping now we're 2 days past Halloween, this one will be less so, because this is designed to demonstrate that these are issues that can be effectively managed. And we're really lucky to have an excellent panel today, very lucky indeed. We've got Jan Wies, who's Global Head of Social Impact and Human Rights at Nestlé. We've got Alexander Sykes, Global Sustainable Sourcing Lead at Diageo, and Sophia Gnisch, who's responsible in the team for responsible agricultural supply chains at the OECD. So we're going to start off with Sophia. International organizations have been looking at these issues for a great deal of time, starting probably with the late great John Ruggie with the UN Voluntary Principles. So there's a lot of support that companies can draw on. So I'm going to hand over now to Sophia.
Thanks so much, Peter. Good afternoon, everyone. As Peter mentioned, my name's Sophia. I lead the agriculture sector team at OECD Centre for Responsible Business Conduct. And it's a real pleasure to be here today and learn more about what the wine sector is kind of doing to address these issues, but also to kind of share some of the instruments and tools that OECD has developed over the years to help businesses implement more responsible practices. I wanted to start by providing you with an overview of our kind of key instruments and standards for those of you who might be a bit less familiar. To start with, the OECD guidelines for multinational enterprises on responsible business conduct are the OECD's kind of overarching umbrella instrument and reflect the expectations from governments to business on how to act responsibly. They bring together all thematic areas of business responsibility, including human rights and labour rights, but also information disclosure, the environment, bribery and corruption, consumer interests, science and technology, competition and taxation. And this comprehensiveness is really a unique feature of the guidelines and makes it the only government-backed instrument that really covers all major sustainability risks. The guidelines recently underwent an update to ensure that they're better addressing the kind of evolving societal challenges and changing context for international businesses. And they really aim to encourage business to make a positive contribution to kind of economic, environmental, and social progress, as well as just minimizing adverse impacts that might be associated with their operations, products, and services. The guidelines themselves include an expectation that businesses conduct risk-based due diligence to identify, prevent, and mitigate adverse impacts in their own operations, in their supply chains, and through their business relationships. In order for business to help businesses kind of embed due diligence into their risk management systems, the OECD has developed international standards for due diligence that are both cross-sectoral and sector-specific. For the agricultural sector and agri-food supply chains, the OECD collaborated with the FAO to develop and implement the OECD FAO guidance on responsible agricultural supply chains. This was launched in 2016 following a two-year multi-stakeholder consultation process, and it incorporates not only the recommendations that are contained within the OECD guidelines that I spoke about previously, but also the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights and the ILO M&E Declaration on Social Policy and Inclusive, Responsible and Sustainable Workplace Practices. And although the guidance itself tends to focus on RBC issues that are upstream, it is relevant for all enterprises across agricultural supply chains, including investors. What do we mean by due diligence? Because of late, and as Peter mentioned, we're seeing a growing number of different due diligence measures being introduced by various governments around the world, such as the EU's CSDDD or the deforestation regulation that emerged, the French Loi de Vigilance, or the German Sustainable Supply Chain Act. But there's kind of considerable variation in their design and scope and what they consider to be due diligence. So the OECD standards on due diligence are really embedded within this kind of six-step framework or process, which includes embedding RBC into your corporate policies and management systems, then scoping your activities and supply chain to identify and assess adverse impacts, ceasing, preventing and mitigating those impacts, tracking your implementation and results, communicating your progress, and then providing for or cooperating in remediation where damage has occurred. Importantly, due diligence under the OECD prioritizes action where impacts are the most likely and the most severe. So it's not about addressing low-hanging fruits first. It's really kind of going for the most severe and likely impacts that you're going to see in your supply chain and your operations, and addressing those first and foremost. It considers impacts that are not only caused by a business directly, but also those impacts that a business may be contributing to or directly linked to through its suppliers and business relationships. Importantly, it's flexible and it's tailored to companies of different capacities, sizes and contexts, including SMEs. And it's also dynamic and ongoing. It adapts to changing circumstances and risks, all of which should be informed by really strong stakeholder engagement. And really critically, I think it views disengagement from a risky supply chain as the last resort. Businesses should continue to work with suppliers to address issues over time, as opposed to simply exiting those supply chains and sourcing from elsewhere. To support companies further in addressing kind of specific risks, we recently published kind of two business handbooks on due diligence in the agricultural sector, one addressing deforestation and due diligence in agricultural supply chains, and another one looking at the cocoa sector and child labor and forced labor in the cocoa sector. The handbooks really provide clarity on how to operationalize existing due diligence standards for specific risks and kind of promote a common understanding of those risks and impacts in supply chains. And they include lots of practical information and tips and examples for businesses on how to implement due diligence and reference kind of existing resources that are out there for companies to kind of support their due diligence practices. And today I really wanted to kind of focus on the handbook we developed on child labor and forced labor in the cocoa sector, which I think could be the most kind of useful and interesting in terms of this discussion on forced labor. The handbook was developed in collaboration with the International Cocoa Initiative, who have kind of years of experience working on such issues in cocoa supply chains. And I think really highlights the benefit of consulting with and working with key experts and stakeholders when you're assessing and addressing risks and impacts in your supply chains. To give you an idea of the scale of the issue, in 2020, 5.8 million tons of cocoa beans were produced globally, and 38% of this production came from Côte d'Ivoire, Ghana, and then followed by Ghana and Indonesia. And 29,000 people are estimated to be operating in conditions of forced labor in Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana. And 16,000 of these are children, and over 13,000 are adults. So that kind of gives you an idea of the scale of the challenge. And I just wanted to kind of touch on what exactly do we mean when we're talking about forced labor. So ILO defines forced labor as all work or service which is exacted from a any person under the menace of any penalty, and for which the said person has not offered himself voluntarily. So it's got two elements to it, one of coercion and another of a lack of free and informed consent, that are really, really critical to understanding forced labor. The handbook that we developed for the cocoa sector kind of really includes a lot of practical insights and things that the business can use when conducting due diligence. So advice on risk indicators for assessing child labor and forced labor, what to include in a risk prevention and mitigation plan, information on how to monitor and track the implementation and effectiveness of a company's commitments and activities, advice on how to provide for or cooperate in remediation, advice for collaborating with governments or existing initiatives, child rights groups and labor experts, for example. It also provides kind of considerations for SMEs, and also considerations for businesses that operate downstream and are kind of further removed physically along the supply chain from where a lot of the kind of major harms occur. And I couldn't kind of go into enormous amounts of depth on the handbook itself with the time we had. So I thought I'd just take a quick look at kind of one of the main steps in the handbook on understanding the indicators for assessing child and forced labor. So the handbook provides a kind of a useful and simple framework for understanding if forced labor is taking place or is a risk within your supply chain. So very simply, it provides examples of indicators for involuntariness or for menace of penalty, such as abusive requirements for overtime or work in hazardous conditions, or threats of violence against workers, or withholding wages or important documents. And it says if at least one of these indicators of involuntariness or menace of penalty is present, then there is a risk of forced labor and preventative action is needed. If there is an indicator of both involuntariness and menace of penalty, then you're looking at a situation where forced labor is taking place and action is required. But despite this kind of very simplified kind of approach, it can still be really challenging for downstream businesses to have a clear picture of activities on the ground. So when you are a downstream business, what does mapping and assessing look like for you? And within the handbook, in the case of the cocoa sector, when we're looking at mapping the supply chain, we say, well, work with your first tier suppliers to get visibility on the sources of cocoa, including identifying control points or bottlenecks in the supply chain where high volumes are being traded through a single entity, for example, and establish systems of control further upstream in the supply chain. Be consistent in your requests and underline the importance of knowing the source of your cocoa and have visibility of the business relationships that are involved in your sourcing. Support companies or organizations upstream from your business who may have less capacity to map their supply chain by investing in capacity building activities and resources. If you're an SME, this can look like this should include collaborating with other businesses, for example, through national platforms or industry initiatives to increase leverage and demand for systems of control and supply chain transparency. You can also engage with credible certification schemes to kind of build greater transparency. And when it comes to identifying and assessing risks, you should be reviewing the due diligence measures that are put in place by your suppliers, or directly assessing their operations if you are able to do that, by conducting visits to farms and to communities. You should seek information on both the supplier's systems and the volumes of products that they're supplying to you and look at and whether those tally. Again, participating in industry-wide schemes and multi-stakeholder initiatives to obtain relevant information, and request documentation from upstream companies, such as evidence that the supply chain has been mapped and farms within the supply chain are carrying out on-the-ground monitoring, et cetera. As an SME, similarly, when you're conducting assessments, make use of the wide range of resources from industry and initiatives that are available. And in many instances, SMEs actually prefer to buy directly from farms so that they can have a kind of very detailed knowledge of their supply chain and understanding of the conditions under which cocoa is being grown and harvested. So this was just a kind of a quick snapshot of some of the information that's already out there, some of the instruments and tools that are available to businesses. I'd really encourage you to download the resources that we have that are all freely available on OECD website. But for now, I'll leave it there and very happy to answer questions later on in the webinar. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much indeed for that. As I said at the top of the meeting, you know, there is guidance out there which is deeply practical. Even if all the specifics aren't entirely completely relevant for the wine sector, the general approach absolutely is. Various things strike. One, from what you were saying, one is the question of addressing SMEs. And one of the challenges we face in a lot of issues in the wine sector is there are quite a lot of small businesses, but for all of the, you know, Conchitoros, the Treasury Wine Estates, the MHs, you've got a lot of very small family-run vineyards. And so this demonstrates you can scale an approach, and the approach can be the same no matter how big or small you are. And also the need to be dynamic, that part of the challenge with human rights is it does morph. And that when one challenge is identified and addressed, it comes back somewhere else. So there's that need to constantly refocus on what's going on. And the need for stakeholder engagement. I mean, one of the global standards in wine, which I think does human rights pretty well, is the WETA standard in South Africa. And they require those going to certify on wine farms to actually work with a local NGO to understand the specifics of how human rights abuses may exist in that location. Also collaboration with government. You know, this isn't just a corporate problem. I mean, going back to John Ruggie, his three principles were governments protect, companies respect. So I think being able to engage with government, I think, is important. And also, thank you for the plug about participating in collective groups, because we rather think that SWR could be the vehicle for doing exactly that. So, Sophia, thank you very much indeed. Now, what we've got from that presentation is in a sense that there's high quality guidance available for companies working in all sectors. But it's also important to understand that other sectors are already addressing these issues and have been for a long while. So we're going next to Jan Wies from Nestle. So Jan, over to you.
Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you for having me as part of this discussion. I would highlight one element, which is the human rights impact assessments that we started carrying out back in 2009. Because Peter, you said that some people were actually scared by, you know, the amount of knowledge that is required maybe to go into this field. And I would say that it's scary until you actually get started. And these human rights impact assessments that we started back in 2009 really like helped us understand what is it that we are talking about. So when we are a multinational company like Nestle and we operate in Colombia, Nigeria, Angola, Russia, Sri Lanka, you name it, what types of like impacts are we talking about? So it has really like helped us demystify a bit this business and human rights concepts and understand much more practically what that means for us from an operations perspective, but also from a supply chain perspective. And then basically all the rest has been developed as part, or I would say on the back of these human rights impact assessments, integrated the results of these assessments into our risk matrices, also like integrated the results into our monitoring and audit processes, and then also working quite a lot in the last few years on the governance structure, trying to identify and define roles and responsibilities at all levels of the company. The last step, one of the last steps of our journey is this, the release of what we call the Human Rights Framework and Roadmap. It's a new version of a program that we had launched already back in 2011 that we called Human Rights Due Diligence Program that was very much aligned with the UN Guiding Principles and the previous version of the OECD guidelines. But this human rights framework also recognizes like all the developments that have taken place out there, and also like all the learnings that we have been able to gather along the journey. And so this is what the framework looks like. You will see that it's not completely dissimilar from the OECD guidance. So it also actually comes with a circle, but you see that due diligence is at the center of the framework. So this is what we actually aim for. So improve as a company operating literally like in each country of this world. So elevate our level of due diligence where this is necessary. So where we face risks, making sure that we have the right level of due diligence, so assessing risks, addressing them, reporting on them, based on the risks. But this is also the recognition that due diligence cannot operate in isolation. So you need actually enablers, what we call enablers here, for a company like ours to actually deliver on this due diligence. One of these enablers is around governance that I mentioned before, and incentives, making sure that people are incentivized actually to work on this agenda and rewarded for what they do in that space. Having the right policies and control systems in place. I've already talked about how we integrated human rights into our audit and monitoring mechanisms, making sure that we also do engage with external stakeholders, can be regulators, investors, can be CSOs or NGO organizations, and also like advocates as part of the ongoing legislative processes or policy developments. Strategic partnerships, we do have capacities, capabilities internally. We have teams dedicated to the agenda, but it's not enough. You will see in a moment that the challenge that we face is quite commensurate, and so quite broad and big and daunting. So we actually do need help from external partners, organizations, and finally transparency and reporting, making sure that we do actually report and share what we learn, but also the challenges that we face along the way. So as part of this due diligence piece that is at the center of the human rights framework and roadmap, we have identified 10 what we call salient issues. So the most important issues from a people perspective. And again, they don't come out of the blue, you understand. I mean, they really come from this 15 years experience working on the ground, interacting with a number of people. And you see that these issues actually span across the entire value chain. So typically issues like child labor and forced labor that Sophia mentioned, we would actually find them in what we call the upstream supply chain. So at the farm level, and sometimes, you know, it's like dozens of tiers remote from us, you know, with a lot of intermediaries between us and the farmers. Other issues are much closer to us, so to our own operations, like living wage of our own employees, or gender equity, non-discrimination, non-harassment, safety and health. And other issues are much more related to what we call the downstream supply chain. So the way that we market our products, the way we sell our products, and also the content itself of our products. So really, like from farmer to consumers, these are the issues, the human rights issues that for us are the most salient, so the most material, if you will, from a people perspective. And for each of these issues, we have now developed a dedicated action plan. So we have an action plan that is, by the way, publicly available. So an action plan on child labor and access to education, one on on forced labor and responsible recruitment and so forth. That really helps us be better organized, channel the resources where they need to be, and also gather the teams that need to be involved to deliver on these action plans, and also help us connect with the colleagues that we have in the country operations. We are quite a decentralized company, and make sure that we work as teams, global and local teams, to deliver on these action plans. Now, I would like to, I actually picked Cocoa because I knew that Sophia would actually talk about Cocoa, but please bear in mind that in total, as Nestlé, we have 14 raw material supply chains that are priority from a responsible sourcing perspective. So cocoa is one of them, but of course, coffee, fresh milk, cereals, fish, palm oil are other raw material supply chains that are also in scope of this work, and for which we also have like dedicated action plans. So I just picked cocoa, so I thought it would be like a nice segue from Sophia's presentation, but what I'm going to present can actually be applied, you know, of course, with variations to other supply chains that we operate, because the reality is that the more you look and the more you find. So there is not a single supply chain that, you know, like we use to source our ingredients and raw materials where there is no issue. It just doesn't exist, or at least not that I know of. So cocoa, so basically, as I said, we participated actively through ICI to the OECD guidance, and that was really mainly based on this work. that we started already back in 2010, and the setup of this child labor monitoring and remediation system. I certainly don't have the time to go in the details here, but one thing I would like to share with you is that it's not a parallel system to our supply chain. So it's not something that we do in parallel as part of a CSR program or philanthropic program. It has been fully integrated into the buying structure. So basically the different tiers. And the nice thing about Cocoa is that it's not a very complicated supply chain. I mentioned sometimes supply chains with dozens of tiers between us and farmers. Cocoa is relatively simple. This is basically farmers, farmer cooperatives, traders or suppliers, and us. So four tiers. Compared to others, this is quite simple. And the idea is really like to build capabilities in all tiers of our supply chain. So of course, starting with us, so having the right people, the right Nestlé employees, including agronomists, when they actually go to the farms and visit the farms, making sure that they are equipped to identify some situations that could be at risk of child labor or forced labor. So this is important, but also relying on the traders that we buy cocoa from. So making sure that they own agronomists, and they have more than us actually, are equipped and trained on these issues. Making sure that the farmer cooperatives are also equipped to gather the data that is generated at the farm level. Because at the farm level, what we have done is develop a network of community liaison people. So these are members of the community that go actually from one farm to the other or one family to the other to gather the information that we need to assess the level of risk of child labor and take action. But take action in a tailored way, so based on the needs of the family. And it can be very different from a family to the other, even within the same community. Sometimes the reasons why children actually work in cocoa plantations and don't go to school is because they don't have a school kit or because they don't have a birth certificate. Or sometimes it can be a bit more serious and challenging because, you know, there is no school in the community. So these are all different situations that we actually need to understand to be able to take action and make a difference. And as you can see here on the right-hand side of the slide, we actually report on what we do on the ground in terms of like number of children that we have been able to help, number of children at risk, and what we can do actually to remediate to these situations. So this is how it started. And of course, you know, we've been able to really improve things drastically and dramatically, I would say, like on the ground, to the extent that now, like all the big cocoa and chocolate players have such a system in place. So I think we have managed to inspire also like others, including also through OECD guidelines, but really like inspire other players to set up similar systems. But we see that this is still an issue. So it's not that, no, we have been able to really like change completely the way that child labor plays in the cocoa sector. So now actually, in the last 2 years, we have been focusing a lot on living income, because one of the root causes of child labor is actually poverty. And basically the fact that most of the farmers in countries like Ivory Coast, Ghana, and others, many others, cannot really like make a living income. And so we have actually made quite a strong commitment to help farmers achieve or meet this living income. And you see here that the gap is quite significant. So if you look at the baseline and the actual farmer's income, it's actually just 50% of what should be like the living income benchmark. And the living income benchmark is basically barely what a family needs to you know, like make ends meet, basically like to have decent food and access to education, health, housing, and also like some unexpected events. So we actually came up with this income accelerator program. And it's important because it goes actually beyond just the child labor monitoring system. It actually looks at one of the root causes of child labor. And as I said, this is poverty. I won't go too much into the details here, but the idea is really the idea is to incentivize farmers to change behaviors. And this is where it becomes important, because very often, you know, sometimes we see human rights or social impact in isolation. And here, actually, this is how we make the connection with the overall sustainability of the sector. So how are we going to incentivize cocoa farmers to adopt good agricultural practices that we know that for agriculture is absolutely key, especially regenerative agriculture? How are we going to incentivize farmers to also go into agroforestry activities or to diversify their incomes? And here comes cash incentives. We actually identified cash incentives as the way to make meaningful change. I'm sure that as companies or maybe with partner organizations, you train farmers on good agricultural practices or other practices that needs to be implemented in the wine industry. And in our from our experience, we see that when farmers actually come to the training, only 17% of them go back to their field and implement these practices. And when actually this training comes with cash incentives, the percentage jumps to 90 or 95% because actually they see that we value actually this training. We see that for us, the farmers see that for us, this is important. And so we are ready actually to pay for that. And this is making a big difference and also help actually address the gap that there is between actual incomes and living income. So I'll leave it there. What I wanted to show with this is that, yes, human rights is a lot about compliance and due diligence. It can be scary at times because, you know, it can be complex and it's a lot of like things and issues to deal with. But it's also an opportunity to link this agenda that is very much centered on people with other agendas. And this is really what we are doing at Nestlé. So link it with also our climate zero net roadmap, with our plastic packaging strategy or our water stewardship program. So really making sure that people are at the center of what we do and that we reward them for the benefits they provide to the environment and to local communities, because very often this is overlooked. So it's not only purely a compliance approach, but it's also like an opportunity as part of your overall sustainability agenda.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, I think your opening comment is absolutely right. You know, first of all, understand the problem. And that's really what this series of workshops is trying to encourage people in the wine sector to do. At the moment, I think there's quite a lot of reluctance or even scaredness to look at some of these issues. But as you say, you look at the issues, at least then you understand what you're facing into and then can start to do something about it. I think also another key point you say is that these aren't always issues where you have complete ability to entirely solve them. Particularly something like child labour in West Africa. It's a systemic, it's a societal issue. It's not per se the fault of the cocoa sector. It's a systemic issue that you can play a part in addressing. And I think that comes back to the point that Sophia was making about, you know, working with government. You know, it's not like some of the environmental issues where you can, you know, if you want to reduce your carbon, you just invest in something that emits lower carbon and it's quite binary. These are more complicated issues. But I think that key point about understand what the problem is and demystify it and then just put a plan in to sort it out. It's like any other business activity. It's find out what the problem is, put in a series of steps to address it. So thanks very much. Good to sort of have two on cocoa as well, so that we can sort of see both sides of the equation. Right, so we're going to go from even more close to wine now. We've gone from some of the stuff that we, when we're drinking our wine, we're now going to someone else, another company that actually makes alcoholic beverages. So I'm going to hand over to Alex Sykes from Diageo.
Perfect, thank you. So I'm not going to talk about cocoa, which I'm going to talk about sugar, actually, as a case study. And brush quickly over the OECD guidelines, which Sophia shared earlier, to how we got here and how we prioritized this. For those of you who haven't heard of Diageo, you may have recognized some of our brands. We mainly do spirits and then that black stout you might recognize as well. We do talk a lot about people and being an alcoholic drinks company, focus on people in your supply chain and how you create your brands and then your consumers is really important. That kind of leads into our sustainability targets. So a lot of these are our 2030 programs. So we're looking around positive drinking, inclusion and diversity, and then our grain to glass sustainability, which breaks down into water, packaging and carbon with a big focus on regenerative agriculture. And then underpinning that is how we support human rights. So this is really my area and looking after responsible sourcing in our supply chain. That leads us on to addressing salient risks and using that OECD guidelines model. And in order to do this, it's really important to prioritize salient risks, because otherwise you've got this huge supply chain, you're not really sure where to start. We only have limited time and resource. So we look at a couple of different things, and I'll very quickly explain this table to you. But what we want to do is create essentially a carbon footprint for human rights, because if I'm going to get buy-in from my exec, I need to really break this down into something they can understand at a numerical level. And then we can attach that to each of our brands so we can see, you know, who's having the biggest human rights footprint as such. For this, we look at what are our severity of our risks, so the scope, the scale, how easy we can remediate it, and the likelihood of that occurring in the future. And as you can see, I won't go through it, but we can share these slides. That provides a scoring against all of these areas. Then what we do is we bring in the attribution and the leverage that we have. So that's where we look at our supply chain. And a little bit like what Jan was saying, is sometimes it can be many tiers away from you, and therefore it's difficult for us to really leverage the risk. We might have to work with our suppliers, or it might be less of a priority. So this is the methodology bit. It gets a bit more exciting after this, but that's how we came to our case study on sugar. This case study fits under the umbrella of just transition and the integration of climate change and human rights, where we're really looking at two different areas. So one is transition to low carbon economy and how we can protect people through that. And the other area, which I'll focus on today, is really about what are the direct impacts of climate change, and particularly in this case study, heat, on people in our supply chain. And then just a little technical bit down the bottom. So we look at systemic risk and operational risk. Systemic risk is something that exists that you can't really change. So for example, we buy sugar. Sugar is produced in hot countries. Therefore, there's the risk of heat stress on people. We're never going to be able to change that as long as we keep buying sugar from those countries. Operational risk is what your supplier has set up to manage that risk. And that's the bit that we can really influence and change to therefore make the systemic risk less impactful. And that is really what this case study focuses on. The reason why we're looking at heat stress is there's been quite a lot of research done into this area and the impacts of heat on workers in sugarcane and how it affects kidney disease. So you can really link sort of communities that are based around big sugar plantations to hospitals, and you can cross connect the link between chronic kidney disease and those that are working within it. So there's some great NGOs that have done lots of research in this space, and that sort of enabled us to be aware that actually we're buying this in our supply chain, therefore we must be connected to the issue. And then just on the right, this is very recent, but I wanted to sort of bring your attention that this isn't just sugar. This is anything where you've really got manual labor in heat in your supply chain. So recently there's been lots of research about migrant workers who are helping build stadiums in Qatar for the Football World Cup, who've sort of gone back to their countries. And again, we're seeing huge issues of kidney disease from those workers as well. It's just a very quick video that I will play. So for those of you who may have never seen sugarcane before and how it's cut, this is just a quick example. So it's cut by hand. You can use mechanization, but for some fields, it's not possible. So workers are paid by how much they cut, and it's pretty exhausting because it's hard work, and they're consistently working throughout the day. Very manual, and it's exhausting. When we were stood here, it's very hot. You can't really see it through the video, but it was hot just stood there, never mind going through what they're going through. So that's really the risk that we're trying to work through. Now, reaching a solution in this area is not that complicated. So we know what the risk is. We know how it impacts people, but we have no idea how to solve it. So we've partnered with several organizations. So there's an NGO called La Isla Network, who I think might be on a future presentation, and they'll take you into a lot more detail around this. They are occupational health experts who know how to bring awareness and address this in the field. The US Department of Labor really helps with a lot of funding. And then Bonsucra, the sustainable sugarcane platform. So within their certification standard, they can help integrate this risk. So it's sort of managed on our behalf. And I should also mention Vin Monopolet, who I think are on this call today and sponsored these webinars, have been a fantastic partner and helped bring us along this journey as well. So the solution to help protect workers from heat is fairly simple. It's about water, it's about rest, and it's about shade. Making sure workers are given water, making sure that water is insulated so it's cold and therefore brings your body temperature down. The shade has to be mobile, because if you're working through a field, and you can see that from the video, they're fast and they work quickly. So if you have a static shade, it won't be impactful. It has to be something that you can move around a field. And then if you're asking people to drink a lot more water, then you're going to need sanitation. I'll take you to a bit more about the solution. We've done two pilot studies on this. Once we realized that we're going to need to intervene here, we're looking at two different locations. This is all for our rum supply chain. So we're looking at Jamaica and Guatemala. And fortunately, now we're expanding it into many other regions. But the work that we do, again, fairly straightforward. If you look at the top left picture, what's happening there is the NGO, La Isla Network, they strap the workers up with heart rate monitors, and they'll measure their workload throughout the day. And then they'll combine that with the orange mobile phone in the third picture along. And that's called a Kestrel. And that measures wind speed, air temperature, humidity levels, and you sort of combine this data, and that will tell us the level of exposure to heat stress. And I'll show you some of that data on the next slide. We are also looking at PPE, and you can see the difference really between Jamaica and Guatemala if you look at the top right-hand picture and how the workers are protected. And then you compare that to the bottom left in terms of, you can see the insulated water bottle, even from the shin guard, how their clothing protects them. And another thing that's really important, in the bottom left, you'll see a kind of a truck with a black cloth over it. So that just carries water around the fields. And if you have to drink, I can't remember the exact number, but it's something like I use UK limits, but 5 pints of water an hour, which is a lot. And to drink that much, you therefore need to have consistent hydration. So this is kind of the changes that we're trying to make and show, is that the businesses really have to change how they manage this and resource it effectively. So then the last thing I'll just show you is on the bottom right, this is a rest break schedule. So this tells the workers when they can work and when they can't, and when they should rest. And this is really crucial, because when you rest, the data shows that you will increase your productivity, because not only are you more healthy essentially, but you can sharpen your machete and things like that. So best practice is that you'll have a supervisor that will blow a whistle and everyone will stop working, and then you'll hear all the machetes being sharpened, and then they'll blow their whistle again, and you can resume work, and you have to follow that very strictly. And then we'll show you some data that shows you why that's important. What I'm going to show you here is our data from our pilots on the left-hand side. And then this is best practice on the right-hand side, which is, I think, comes from Nicaragua. So on the left-hand side, you can see from our pilot when the workers started, which is at 7 a.m. And you can see the average body temperature goes up very quickly. And then it sort of stays at that throughout the day. You can see between 1 and 2 p.m. the peak. And so workload intensity factors in your body's ability to manage that heat. And we sort of get above 90% between 1 and 2 p.m., which is incredibly dangerous. So this is telling us that, yes, there is severe heat stress in your supply chain. And then best practice on the right-hand side, is where you've got all of the measures in place. And you can see when they stop all the different spikes, and that's essentially rest. They're also starting much earlier in the day and they're finishing much earlier. But we can also look at the volume that they're cutting, and it's more than what we're seeing on the pilot study. So it's not an issue with productivity. And that's important for us, because when we go in and we communicate with our suppliers, we've got to link this to commercials, and we've got to show them that there is real payback here. And again, you can see the highest temperature here is just over 70. So this is where we want to get to. This is our kind of ultimate ambition, and using the best practice, because we can see it does work. Very quickly, just to finish off, we're hoping really only to do this for 3 years, because again, we have limited time and resource. So year one will be about raising the issue with our suppliers who are part of this program, conducting those initial assessments to see what the level of exposure is. Year two will be about addressing those gaps and making sure that they're putting the right management systems in place, they're getting the right equipment. And then year three is about going back to see that has that been effective, and hopefully we've moved towards the graph on the right hand side and moved away from the one on the left. And then just finally, in terms of what we're looking to do here, so it's a fairly simple project, but I think people take it for granted at the moment that this is being managed. From our initial understanding is we think you really do need to get into the detail here and see what's happening, because the effects on people's health can be fatal. So partnering with the right people, whether that's for us with retailers or with NGOs or with government organizations, will help you achieve that change much quicker. Hopefully we can initiate the industry to all be working on this. And for all of you who have manual labor in hot areas in your supply chain, this will be a salient risk for you. So that's it. Thank you.
Brilliant, Alex. Thanks very much indeed. And it's always great to get these sort of really granular examples. Again, what we're trying to do with these workshops is to go from a fairly generic term around human and labor rights to say, what does that actually look like in practice, and divide it up into, instead of being one amorphous problem, it becomes a lot more, but smaller, manageable problems that can be addressed step by step at a time. But I think there's a couple of points you make at the end, I think were very interesting. People take it for granted. I think most people who drink, I presume that sugar cane often goes into your rums, for example, that people wouldn't even think that was an issue anymore, to come back to the champagne example, that people might assume that people died in the making of champagne. So there is a sense, I think, that consumers expect it, and it's a shock to them if they don't. But as you say, getting to the detail, working with the right partners is absolutely key. Right, so we're now at that stage of the afternoon when I'd like to go to the audience and say, has anyone got any questions? Dom.
Hi, guys. Thanks for that. That was really good. My name's Dom. I'm from the Wine Society. I think this is probably a question for Jan and Alex. Don't quite know how to say this diplomatically, but Peter's kind of said at the beginning, I think in wine, one could argue that retailers, and I'm including us as a retailer in this, might be about 15 years behind you guys. And I wondered if you had any advice on how you kind of got started with human rights due diligence in terms of speaking to your suppliers about it. Because I don't think there has been a huge amount of conversation between retailers and growers, you know, wine growers, wine producers, about human rights and about labour conditions. There probably has sporadically, and of course there will be more by some retailers than others, but just as a general theme. So this seems to me to be something quite new in terms of that dialogue, and just wondered if you cast your minds back to when you guys started or your businesses started, any advice you might share to those of us who are starting those conversations with suppliers, and how you went about it and any kind of lessons from it.
Jan, you first.
I started at Nestlé 12 years ago, and I will always remember my first meeting. It was actually with the heads of operations. And this is actually when we initiated this work on child labor that I presented to you. And at the time, you know, there was no clear legislation about these things. And I would say now we are in a complete different landscape, because I think legislation are pushing actually companies to look at it. And this is good and bad at the same time, but that's another topic. But basically, I will always remember him saying to our suppliers, either you are in with us and you help us implement, or you're out of the supply chain. But it can only actually happen when we have this leverage position, right? When we are a big player, like in a sector, and you can actually like push for things. And I do appreciate that, you know, it's not always the case. So we can do it for coffee, for cocoa, because we are major players, but we need to use other tactics, including collective action, working with governments, other companies, organizations, in other sectors like palm oil, for example. So that would be my answer to your question, Dom.
Just to build on it. So we're always starting as well every day. It might be that we acquire a new brand, or we're merging or something like that, and you'll be working with a completely new region or a new supply chain you've never worked with before, and you are starting from scratch. So we have these conversations a lot, and it's not like we're always at a position where we can do these, you know, really interesting projects on the ground. A lot of the time we're going through policies, and we're looking through documentation, and we're talking about minimum standards and requirements. But I think, and just to kind of lean on Jan's presentation, yes, the idea of sort of setting policies, doing assessments with them against those policies is really key, but going for both the carrot and the stick, and looking at incentives and how you can make it seem interesting and not just a constant stick as such.
Yeah, thanks for that. I think it's how that engagement works, I think, is key. More questions come to you.
I'll try. I pulled over to the side of the road so I can ask a question, Peter. So
I'm glad you're not questioning and driving. That would be dangerous.
No, I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you. And obviously trying to think about how that relates to our supply chain. I'm based here in California. And so we maybe have some more advanced rules and things in place, but I'm very aware of the conversation that, or the point that was made, that was, doesn't matter where you look, you'll go find something. So I'm wondering if any panelists have any good examples of sort of California or European examples of going and looking in supply chain for risk like this, and how they've dealt with it.
I have two very concrete examples. This is the child labor situation in the US. And by the way, not only in the agricultural supply chains, but also like in the manufacturing environment that, to be honest with you, we are looking at quite closely right now, based on what has happened in the last few months. And the other example would be in the UK. I was on a call with colleagues yesterday, actually. They are looking at modern slavery. By the way, including of the risk of modern slavery in our own operations, especially related to contractors. So, I mean, this is closer to what you think. So, of course, the agricultural supply chains is really like where for us the risks are, you know, like child labor, forced labor. This is where they are the most salient. But these things happen actually closer to what you think.
Anyone else wanted to add anything on that?
Yes, I just wanted to say I completely agree with Jan on this. And I think often sometimes the challenge can be that the regulations and the kind of measures that we're seeing from government do have a kind of focus on trade and developing countries and emerging economies. But I think there are a number of examples, particularly when it comes to labor, in certain parts of the, you know, agricultural supply chains, where there are very clear risks in Europe, the US, and you know, and maybe these aren't coming to the fore as easily as they do in kind of some of the, I think specifically of kind of higher risk agricultural commodities, like for example sugarcane or cocoa, but they definitely do still exist. And I just wanted to come up on the previous question that was asked about kind of where do you start. And I think I kind of mentioned it briefly in the presentation, but the idea that due diligence is dynamic and everyone is supposed to is starting somewhere. And as long as you're making progress, it doesn't really matter kind of how how, you know, you don't, no one's expecting you to go from zero to hero straight away. I think the idea is that what, if you can demonstrate your progress in terms of understanding the risks, developing those policies, reaching out, engaging on the issue, that in itself is what's important. And then over time you get there, but no one is expecting you to be able to solve, you know, human rights issues and labor issues within your supply chain within the next, you know, month. You know, that's a process.
And Peter, just to add very quickly, sorry, but you know, when we talk about forced labor, for example, we're not talking about, you know, like enslaved workers, but it can be also like very subtle things like, you know, like workers having to pay recruitment fees. Mm. And so this is something that, you know, we need to understand to fully appreciate the full range of the risks that we face. And this is something that is quite difficult to detect. And even to remediate, you need actually to, you know, like trace actually the workers, where they come from and the different agencies that they had to go through to get a job. And so I do believe that it could potentially apply to your sector as well, including in, you know, like developed countries like the US or Europe, by the way.
I think that's right. I think, and again, just what you've just been saying, Sophia, echoes what one of the speakers of the last session said, which is that the biggest mistake is not to look for the problem, that actually going out there and seeing what's there has got to be the right thing. Coming next to Sasha Monique.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Peter. My name is Sasha, and I'm from Wien Monopole, one of the sponsors for this series. To just answer the question with regards to which incentive, which activities one could activate within your supply chain, especially when you're new to this field, do feel free to contact us at the Nordic Alcohol Monopolies. Together, we are sponsoring several projects that are available for free for producers based on our salient risks. So, for example, in Italy, we've had a focus on responsible recruitment, because migrant workers and seasonal workers are at risk of being trafficked. And that's with a partner called Stronger Together, who are also, they provide guidance in the US market on responsible recruitment from Mexico. So that might be interesting for the gentleman that asked about what type of initiatives are there available and what could one do in California, perhaps.
Thanks for that. Any comments from the panel? In that case, I'll go to a question that's been asked in the chat, building on what Sophia was saying. How do you incentivize smaller companies who may not be subject to some of the legal requirements to integrate responsible business practices in their operations?
This remains a kind of challenge. And as much as we kind of, within our instruments and standards, really try and make sure that we speak to SMEs in terms of adapting due diligence to their size and contacts and capacities, I can understand that it regardless of that, it still seems kind of quite an overwhelming task. But I think it's important to recognize not only that due diligence can be feasible at whatever scale, and it should be adapted to you know, and it can be adapted to your operations, and everyone of whatever size can be making progress on issues such as kind of labor and human rights. But I think one of the things with the kind of key messages and key incentives is that for businesses, this is not just about kind of meeting regulatory requirements. It's also about the resilience and sustainability of your operations going forward, both in terms of kind of some of the risks that are more out of our control, like the ones that Alex was talking about in terms of climate change and you know, things that are kind of systemic or issues or environmental issues that you know, that will threaten your operations and your supply chains anyway. So looking into that will be positive for your business in the long term, and addressing those kind of risks and issues. But also, I think from a very kind of a business perspective, in terms of your consumers becoming increasingly aware of this as a topic, you mentioned in your opening remarks, Peter, about kind of drops in sales of champagne, whether or not it was linked to that particular report or discovery. But this is, I mean, in other commodities and other sectors, I mean, this has been detected. There is proof that the consumers and retailers and others are increasingly aware of this as an issue. And so I think if you're talking, you're thinking about kind of your business's long-term sustainability, its growth going forward, these are issues that you cannot avoid. And so addressing them in whatever capacity you can is really critically important.
I think also it's worth just putting a little addendum to that, that not just in wine, but in the wine value chain as well. Even if you're a small business, the fact is that the people that you sell to are subject to these requirements. So if you're trying to sell into, you know, retailers, into restaurants, the fact that you as a small producer may not be subject to some of the legal requirements, the person at the end of the line certainly is, and they're increasingly asking those questions. And I think being able to make sure you can answer them effectively is important. But I think also I come back to the point that Jan said, it's moving beyond just compliance, as in a sort of slightly grudging, well, I suppose we ought to do this, to actually something which is a thoroughgoing part of the way in which the business is run. But that takes time. And as you said just now, Sophia, you can't do it all at once. Any more questions from the floor? Okay, in which case what I'll do is I'll just ask each of the speakers just very briefly to sum up with perhaps two or three key points that you'd like the audience to take away, and keep it sharp. Two or three points. It's you first, Sophia.
Two or three takeaways from this. Really kind of what my takeaways from this session have been, that from what it sounds like from the questions we've heard, this is seemingly quite new to the wine sector. That can be incredibly daunting, especially when you know, we brought these wonderful speakers today to talk about their experiences in cocoa and in sugarcane, and looking at what they're doing, it can seem incredible, you know, you're a million miles away. But I think the thing to take away from it would be kind of one of my last points, which has been the important thing is to start doing the research, to start understanding the problem, and just start making steps going forward. Due diligence is an ongoing process. And so there isn't an expectation for you, you know, for everything to change now, but just get started and be dynamic, engage with stakeholders, with experts, reach out to others and build that kind of community of practice within the wine sector. And I think that's what we've seen other businesses in other sectors doing. And I think it's a great model to kind of follow.
Great. Jan.
Yes, I agree. Start small. I mean, do either like an audit or an impact assessment in one of your wine plantation together with a third party organization. We did it with the Danish Institute for Human Rights back then, like back in 2008. But now there is a myriad of organizations providing their services. Pick one and do it. I myself participated in all these impact assessments. And I must say that I've learned a great deal from it. And this is really based on these assessments and the results of them that we have built our program. So that would be my recommendation, the recommendation I always make to newcomers in this field.
Great stuff. Thank you. Alex?
One is prioritize your impact and make sure your attention is focused on those who need it most. And then secondly, be really positive and communicate a lot about what you've achieved. That will help engage people.
Brilliant. And I think, Toby, you just wanted to say a couple of words.
Yeah, just very briefly, thanks so much to the panel and to you, Peter. Peter and I have worked on these issues outside wine for 20-odd years with Jan and with Diageo and with Sophia in other industries. You know, the genie's out of the bottle, and it's taken quite a while to come out in wine. But what we've observed over the years is once this starts appearing in the media, once regulators take an interest, once enforcement agencies take an interest, you know, that there's no going back. And that is a good thing. But there's a great opportunity to get suppliers, to get producers, to get on board early and turn this into an opportunity. And the labor shortages we see now are exactly that opportunity. I just posted something in the chat from Menninger's today about with a fascinating graph on labor shortages across wine. There is competition for talent, and that goes all the way down to migrant labor. Mm. People don't want to do those jobs if they don't have to. So there's a stick here, which is that we at SWR will be hugely encouraging our retail members and others to take a systemic approach to this, and that has to happen. But secondly, that, and perhaps more importantly in some ways for business, there's just tremendous opportunity here to become that employer of choice. Mm. And I think if there's one message I'd like to leave us with, that it's that.
Thanks very much, Toby. Just a final wrap up with sort of where this process goes next. As I said, this is the second of three workshops looking at human rights in wine. And we've started off with the what do we mean by the issues. Today, we've looked at what's out there to support the industry and what have other industries done. And next time, we're going to be looking specifically at existing initiatives within the wine sector. Where we take it thereafter, I think one of the things that we're definitely exploring is to come back to Sophia's expression about a community of practice, to produce a series of analyses that look at what the proximate issues might be in certain wine growing areas. So rather than talk generally about migrant labor or forced labor, to build on the sort of examples that Jan was talking about in other sectors, to start to say, well, what might the problems be growing area by growing area, but to have those as in camera, so private documents, which will allow the industry to say, right, this is how the problem manifests in this location, how we collectively going to address it. So I think that's a direction we want to move in. But the in the immediate future, we've got a third workshop coming up later in November. So I hope to see you all there again. Before closing, just thank you so much to the speakers. These meetings are made by the quality of the inputs, and you've all been fabulous. So to Sophia, Jan, and to Alex, thank you so very much for a really fascinating hour and a quarter.